at 3, 20 degrees in Racine, 17 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And for this portion of WGTD's morning show, I'm really happy to be speaking with a young man by the name of Benjamin Horvat. And I met Benjamin when we sang together in a production of Giancarlo Minotti's Christmas opera, A Mall and the Night Visitors, several years ago. I was one of the wise men, and he was the page, and it was fun to make his acquaintance and to hear about the things that he was doing as a musician in the area, in particular teaching music at one of the Lutheran high schools here in southeastern Wisconsin. But now Benjamin Horvat is spending most of his time with a very exciting undertaking that we are going to be talking about for the next few minutes. He has a company called Lewis Structures. And they are about the business of repurposing unrecycled trash, recycling it into cubes and pellets that can be used for construction. And we're going to be talking with him about the technology that we're discussing and the whole process of patents, which is a very complicated process that most of us have no understanding of whatsoever. And, of course, we will also talk about the landfill crisis that confronts our country and, for that matter, other countries around the world, and the very exciting possibility that that this technology that Benjamin has helped to develop could be at least part of the answer to some of those really pressing concerns and issues. His company is, again, is called Lewis Structures. And Benjamin Horvat, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg Berg, it's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Glad we can have this conversation. Ahead of us talking about Lewis Structures and so on, maybe you could just say a quick word about where you come from originally and kind of life's path that ultimately took you to the Kenosha Racine area.
Yeah, Lewis Structures concepts have been kind of rolling around in my head since probably 2010, something like that. I've had a dream for years to take my education in music and make high-level productions that would be inspirational in churches and maybe connect that with training events and so forth to empower people. And so that's been a dream for 20 years. And when I've had some major setbacks where I just couldn't get the funding to do things that I wanted to do at a high quality level. In about 2010 or so, when the market had crashed, I was just going to have my my first home purchase, and I was looking for a cheap property, and I found a beautiful wooded land, and then I was inundated while walking around with this highway noise, and the noise pollution led me to wonder whether I could make a berm that would block out the highway noise. And I started researching that and got connected to an engineering firm that eventually said, yeah, we think what you want to do might actually be possible, that you could have a berm that would be tall enough that the noise wouldn't jump over this retaining wall, and it would be effective. And this company said, yeah, we'd give you 8,000 truckloads of dirt if you wanted to place it on this property. From that, eventually it turned into a gated community subdivision proposal that would be a fundraiser to help the area community with youth events and artistic events. I wanted to have this land development project that would be a beneficial use of clean construction debris with a berm around it that would block out the highway noise. That was a design of a musician that didn't have any experience, but I ended up with a number of engineering firms and legal firms and just a wonderful team that helped me present this to some area city development municipalities. And from that, eventually they said this is viable and you could save $10 million in infrastructure costs by the beneficial use of construction debris. So it didn't go through, but eventually that ended up being patent claims on a beneficial use of garbage. And now I'm so glad to say that some of those initial designs are still viable to this day. And now I have a number of patent claims that would take household trash and make it into a construction cube with my LLC, Lewis Structures.
So all of this started out in some ways from kind of an unrelated project that would have involved constructing something and then figuring out what to make it out of. And eventually it comes to this thing then, this company called Lewis Structures. So apparently at the heart of it is this notion of being able to construct walls, different kinds of walls, using trash. Is that what you meant before when you were talking about the possibility of using, I don't remember what the
clean construction debris.
Yeah, construction debris. So what would be an example of construction debris?
Yeah, so when you tear down a house, the timber and the plaster that comes from that is a certain kind of garbage. It's not food waste. It's not a lot of plastics. It's more wood and drywall. That was the initial thing that I thought I could safely use because it has to have a certification of clean. But municipal solid waste is what we use mostly. Not what we use, what we throw away and don't use. And so at the time I was told there would be no way that you could use that household trash. It's not clean. There's no use for it. And I continually was pushing back, but what if we did this? What if we did that? And eventually I rubbed shoulders with some wonderful scientists that were saying, oh, yeah, we know how to kill the bugs by raising the pH. We know how to chemically treat solid waste. And so I kept on designing something. And I think my music background, my bent is to methodically work on a masterpiece. I've been working on this for a long enough period that I've realized that the trash that we throw away could actually become something that we could beneficially use. So we're making a public hazard and making it into a public benefit.
So this is something that is right now in what we call the patent pending process, and that's part of what you're trying to put all of this together. So in a sense, what is the heart and soul of the breakthrough that has not existed before? Because obviously if you're going to patent something, that means you're in a sense patenting either a product or a process or something that basically doesn't exist, and you, in a sense, are the first. So what has not existed before that exists now?
Yeah, probably for financial reasons, in the solid waste industry, the lucrative thing that companies have done is to make landfills out of trash. Well, in order to make an empty landfill and stick as much trash in there as possible, and it is kind of a easy Band-Aid for the problem of what do we do with our trash. But when we statistically sort trash and make it predictable, whereas formerly it was all over the map, anything you can put in a hole, that's what trash is. That's not something that you want to, you know, be driving your cars over because it could make potholes, or there are too many variables that people did not want to beneficially use this material. But our process shreds material down to a 2-inch size initially. We dehydrate it. We chemically treat it. We have a reaction that takes place that hardens it with some special additives that would be used in the concrete industry. So we're essentially turning it into a hardened calcium carbonate, which is like a concrete, and that makes it into an aggregate. And back years prior to this, there was a form that I became accustomed to using. It's a beneficial use permit. And so if you can find a way that an already approved material is being used, and you can find a different material that can meet the same criteria and parameters of the already approved type, then you can get a beneficial use permit to use that. So I kept on researching, well, how could we make this garbage more predictable? Well, we can make it all into the same size. We can sort it so the same amount of plastics versus paper versus other things are in parts per million in a construction cube. We can make sure that the moisture is a uniform moisture content. We can make sure that all the bugs and bacteria have been killed by raising the pH up to an alkaline level. And then we can harden it with reliable technology to move forward with that. So we have 8 PhDs that have been contributing, and several engineering firms, and just some really smart people on the team that I've been able to assemble that says, we can do this, and this can be a solution for the landfill crisis that we have today.
Mm-hmm. And to what extent is this already happening? I mean, like, are you already creating these construction cubes and construction pellets? I mean, at least in small quantities?
Yeah, so we're currently crowdfunding with Lewis Structures on Facebook, a link to go there. A shameless pitch here for some help, but we have done a number of trials with a lab in California, and also a test lab in Georgia. We have some large companies that are helping us as well, and so we're narrowing in on the bullseye. But our scientists are saying that we're within range of our perfect product, that we basically get thousands of tons of this material and create this particular shape with this degree of reliability with the inert aspects that we want, and we can mass produce that.
And when somebody who wants to build a wall, mm-hmm. I mean, a seawall or a retaining wall or the walls that might line a highway or whatever, what would they do with these cubes and pellets? Would they be melting them down, or or taking a bunch of them and adhering them together? I mean, how exactly would something be constructed from what you are planning to create?
Yeah, so the use of pellets in the past has mainly been burning them, but that's not really good for the air quality of our country. And so we are not melting them down. This is probably the lowest carbon footprint option for trash, we believe, in the nation today. We are just dehydrating and then hardening, essentially, after we get it down to the size that we need. And so aggregate, it is oftentimes, maybe it's a 3/4 inches by 1.5 inch size pellet that's uniform in many different ways. And so if it were to be used as a pebble in a concrete project for cement, you'd want a smoother shape. If you want to use it as a backfill, and that's the dirt that you put on the backside of a retaining wall, then you'd want it more angular with lots of friction between one pellet to the next. So depending on whether we'd use it for concrete or for a backfill, that would determine the particular shape requirements that we're looking for.
Hmm. We're speaking with Benjamin Horvat. He has a company called Lewis Structures, and they have been working to develop a new technology which would involve the repurposing of unrecycled trash, a particular kind of trash that could be turned into construction cubes and construction pellets that could be used primarily or for the creation of various kinds of walls and structures. And Lewis Structures right now is in the midst of what we think of as the patent process. So patent pending is kind of what's the reality hanging over Lewis Structures at the moment. And Benjamin Horvat, I thought it would be interesting to talk with you about what the patent process is like. It's something that's quite important. It goes on all the time, but very much out of sight of the typical person who has nothing to do with the patent process. So first of all, at what point in your process as you worked on this did it become appropriate for you to even apply for various patents? I mean, how far do you have to be along the development arc before it makes sense then to go after a patent?
Yeah, it can be a little unnerving on the front end, because if you wait till you have a large-scale solution to have an initial discussion with a patent lawyer, it might be possible that the word has gotten out and somebody else could take your idea. Or perhaps you have a good idea, but there's been a number of people in Europe or China or on the opposite side of the coast that have already done it. So when I was looking into this, back some years ago, I'd have some initial discussions, and they'd said, well, we don't know if that's original enough. It has to be non-obvious. It has to be original. So I'd have these discussions, and they said, well, we think that you have something that may be patentable. And then we started a provisional patent application, and that allows you a year to work on your ideas. And then a year later, you have to file the non-provisional patent application. So we did that in 2018. May 2017, we did a provisional, and then the non-provisional 2018. And then we have a continuation in part CIP that we've done since then, with additional distinctions and added things that we've made to the initial claims.
So you were telling me before we went on the air that your patent application is actually two major technologies, but then sort of within those 40 derivations. So we're not talking just about I have this great idea for this, but then within that there are all these very specific aspects that also can be, in a sense, patented. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it would be like you don't just patent some kind of personal computer, but you might patent all kinds of various components that are actually part of it and comprise it. Is that sort of what we're talking about here, in a sense?
Yeah. So the initial provisional patent application said it was a low cost wall structure, and then a process for forming landfill material as a backfill, and that gets very specific. There are methodology patents, and then design patents, and so we have a methodology to do this process, and then a certain design that is a way that the usage will meet the government criteria and specifications necessary in order to be approved.
Mm. So do you understand what is happening right now on the other end with these patent applications? I mean, are your applications sitting in a tall pile waiting for them to get to them after they've do these other patent applications that have come in before? Or are they already in the process of examining your applications and already in the process of seriously considering them? I mean, it's maybe not possible for you to even know exactly what's happening on the other end with your applications.
Right. I understand it can take up to a year or two to finally be granted what you've asked for, but there's a PhD that has a number of patents to his name already that has assisted me in the background research of, well, what is an idea that is patentable and how does it need to be structured to fit into the existing landscape of patents that have already been granted in the industry. Hmm. And so he did extensive research for me, and he said, well, it's kind of like a map of where do you put your flag to claim new territory? and he said, well, there's a flag over here on the west side, and on the east side there's another one. But there's this whole middle area that you're claiming that no one has ever claimed before. And I'm going, oh, my gosh, how did I get so blessed to come up with something that hasn't been claimed before? And so he's saying, yeah, he believes that my patents should go through, that they're novel because garbage has been used as an energy source, but actually the BTU value of burning garbage isn't so great. Trash doesn't burn all that well, especially when you look at the environmental impacts of doing so. So pelletizing or cubing trash just hasn't been on the roadmap for whatever reason. In the specific ways when we dehydrate it and then we chemically treat it so it maintains its structural content for a long period of time. They've always been trying to get rid of it or just put it off to the side, and we're saying, no, we want it to be solid and hang around long term because we can use this stuff. This is a public hazard, but we can make it into a public benefit.
Right, right. And so As far as you know, this has not been done before, or certainly not done in exactly this way.
Yes.
Is part of the patent process for them, that is in the U.S. Patent Office, to determine that once and for all? I mean, is part of the process for them to, in a sense, investigate what you are saying in terms of this being a breakthrough technology that isn't already out there?
Yeah. Yeah, they make that determination, and once you're granted it, then you get, I think, up to 17 years of coverage. So a lot of businesses are predicated on, well, we already have the product, we already have the factory, now invest in us. But my model has been, because for whatever reason in the landfill industry, a lot of patents, they just didn't bother to get a patent on it. So this particular usage of garbage is an area that I've been able to claim intellectual property rights for. So in the patent pending stage, if anyone were to try to reproduce the idea, I retroactively could say, well, you can't do that, and if you make money, you have to give it to me for it. So I really have legal standing as of the 2017 date for what I've claimed with the Lewis Structures website. And now, as I've been able to talk to a municipality and say, hey, this is what we intend to do. Would this be of benefit to you? I'm hearing that they're saying, wow, we could save hundreds of thousands of dollars in our small Racine area, and it would be great to implement this technology. Single-stream recycling would make recycling easier. Most people don't know, but it costs over $200 a ton to recycle trash in Racine area. And the landfill fee might be a small portion of that, but we believe that we could save municipalities a substantial amount of money, perhaps up to 20-30% or so. They would save by going to a single-stream recycling solution that we have. And so we have the patent claims to do it, and that would allow us to go to the municipalities and say, we can serve you this way. This will make recycling easier, and single-stream recycling will reduce your costs and be a benefit to the consumer.
If someone already wanted you to build a wall with this technology, would you be permitted to do so, or does this patent process need to finish out, and do you need to secure other approval in order for that to be permissible?
Yeah, we anticipate that in 2019 we could be using this technology on land development sites already. So there's a lot of different patent pending processes that have been mass produced and utilized in the U.S. market way before the patents were finalized. So yeah, we don't have to wait for that. We can get started beneficially using trash as a construction cube very soon.
Hmm. I know that one of the things that makes this especially timely is the fact that, you know, first of all, we all know that way too much is going into our landfills. I mean, it's certainly a problem. But that there are also certain issues related to, for instance, the nation of China no longer wanting some of what we have been shipping to them in terms of recyclables. And that changes the picture rather dramatically, I should think.
Yes. It was January of this year, I believe, when China said, we don't want your recyclables anymore. So not only are we paying almost twice as much to take trash and recycle a portion of it as what we pay to put it in a landfill, now the expensive process of recycling and then shipping it to China doesn't work. So there are a number of ways that recycling is not effective currently in the USA. Because our main solution was to collect it and send it overseas. Overseas doesn't want it anymore. So it's really exciting for Lewis Structures to say, we can do single-stream recycling. So we can recycle the portion that traditionally is recycled through our process, and we can also take the stuff that most people don't want to recycle, and we can beneficially use that as well. So basically a one-stop shop where we can take everything, make it into a construction cube, and then beneficially use it in construction projects.
Hmm. What are your experts telling you about this patent process in which you have these two kind of major claims and then about 40 derivations within them? How likely is it for all of that to be approved versus maybe this component being approved but not that component and so on? And are you kind of prepared for that second scenario, if that's at all likely? I mean, what would that? How big a complication would that be?
Yeah, we have some really good patent lawyers right here in Racine that have been doing this for years and years, And again, the PhD that helped me research this was a runner-up for a Harvard position. They know what they're talking about when they say it is extremely likely that we will be granted many of the claims and then the dependent claims based on that, both for a design patent, which says when retaining walls are used with these components, this is something that Lewis Structures has intellectual property claims on. So no one can use the solution that we have designed for using garbage to construction cube pellets in that that wall design, and then the patents for shredding and dehydrating and raising the pH and then hardening cubes to last long term hasn't been done before, and so we believe that will stick as well. But if they say we're not going to allow you to get the broadest claim, but the more specific ones underneath that you can get, the patent lawyer said, well, if you have exclusive right to ever make anything out of a piece of garbage, that would be like lassoing the moon. You know, you can't do that. but as far as saying, well, when you specifically do X, Y, Z in this order, and then these specific extra things, when that happens, you have control over that. Well, that's much more likely. And so at whatever point they say, yes, we grant you this, then you get to keep that for 17 years, something like that.
Wow. So when is that likely to occur? I mean, how specific can the patent office be in telling you when their decision will finally be shared with you?
Yeah, it sounds like it'll be a year and a half, 2 years when we finally get that designation. But we hope to be serving municipalities in 2019. So we're really excited about that. We hope to have a pilot factory facility about spring of this next year.
Very good. If people want more information about Lewis Structures, I'm pretty sure you have a website that they can seek out.
Yes, lewisstructures.com is our website. And
that's L-O-U-I-S.
Correct, yeah. My middle name from my father, Lewis, L-O-U-I-S, structures.com. And Facebook, Lewis Structures also. And we have a link to start some good crowdfunding campaign, and we'd love for people to even chip in a dollar to say, we'd rather have less landfills and more factories, and our factories, we believe, can produce a product that can reduce infrastructure costs for commercial construction retaining wall solutions.
Benjamin Horvath is responsible for Lewis Structures. Benjamin, it was great to have you here on The Morning Show to have you share with our listeners this very intriguing story. Very best wishes to you with this undertaking.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's been a pleasure.
And the time is 8:43. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg, and here's part two from the archives. Any of you who love to receive or write letters, as I do, will so appreciate a marvelous new book, which is called To the Letter, A Celebration of the Lost Art of Letter Writing. And Simon Garfield, a talented and prolific writer with many books to his credit, has done a superb job of taking us through the long history, the surprisingly long history of letter writing and correspondence, and gets us thinking about it in some very, very intriguing ways. And his book is a treasure trove of examples from throughout history over the centuries of important correspondence between famous people and also plenty of correspondence between perfectly ordinary people. But it helps us understand the way in which intimate letters shared between acquaintances, friends, relatives, often bring them vividly to life the way nothing else can. The book is published by Gotham, and I'm so excited to be speaking with Simon Garfield about his book, To the Letter, A Celebration of the Lost Art of Letter Writing. Simon Garfield, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Good morning, Greg.
You are very careful to say early in the book that this is not a book against email or anti-technology. And yet at the same time, there is, of course, that very strong thread of regret that as we turn increasingly to communication through email, text messaging, and that sort of thing, and turn away from the standard letter slipped into an envelope and mailed at the post office, that we are losing something.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I use emails as much as anyone, you know, and I text and I tweet and all that sort of stuff. And I embrace all of that because that's a modern way of doing things, and it's very efficient, it's cheap, and it's quick, and it works. But as you say, I think we're also facing a great sense of loss, really, because we tend not to write, you know, even emails, certainly not texts or tweets, with anything like the same sort of depth or emotion or thought that one does when one sort of just applies oneself to write a letter. And I think that's a great loss. It's a loss not only to, you know, our grandchildren, perhaps, who won't find, you know, who won't find out about as much as maybe we would find out about our grandparents through their letters, because it's going to be very hard to, you know, get through all our passwords on our computers and the cloud and all of that kind of stuff. A great loss to historians, I think, as well. So, you know, wanting to write the history of famous people now or in 50 years' time, how are they going to track their lives, if not through letters? I think that's going to be hard. But I think even beyond that, we are all losing, I think, the ability to write at a greater length, you know, because all of these things are very instant. You know, you write an email and they tend to be quite short and punchy, and then you write another one because you're replying. It's more like a sort of, you know, a phone chat in a way. You know, a lot of people think that emails are a passing phase, and it's all going to be doing instant messaging and little short messaging, and that's the way we're going to communicate. And very soon it'll all be, you know, visual as well. It'll all be on Skype or the equivalent of something like Skype. So we're not going to leave a written record behind us. And the idea of the book is, as you say, to kind of celebrate what's gone on and the way we've written in the past and great letter writers, but also to ask the question, are we really prepared to lose, you know, all these great attributes that we get from writing a letter?
I want to ask you very specifically about a line from the chapter that opens the book called The Magic of Letters, in which you say the world once used to run upon their transmission, that is, the transmission of letters from one to another. The world once used to run upon their transmission, the lubricant of human interaction and the free fall of ideas, the silent conduit of the worthy and the incidental, the time we were coming for dinner, the account of our marvelous day, the weightiest joys and sorrows of love. It must have seemed impossible that their worth would ever be taken for granted or swept away. A world without letters would surely be a world without oxygen. I think somebody who is young enough to not engage at all in the writing of letters, I mean, they're just too young to live in the world where that was commonplace, would probably read those words and scarcely believe them. Probably can't imagine that. I mean, the world around them seems to function just fine and doesn't need this mysterious lubricant to which you refer. Of course, I'm old enough to know exactly what you're talking about, and I'm wise enough to completely agree. So what does one say to someone who has not really ever in their young lives experienced the world as you describe it?
Well, it's very hard, really, because you can't convince someone of you know a glory of you know a train that used to run by you know by anything other than kind of oil, diesel, or electric. It's hard to say how glorious it must have been once to, you know, be on a coach and horses or any of those kind of things, or the early joys of kind of air travel, you know. And it's because everyone thinks, oh, actually, what, you know, every young person thinks what we have now is the best that there's ever been. And in many ways, that's kind of true, I think. You know, you kind of, you know, as you said at the beginning, I've got nothing against these things because they work and they are absolutely of their day. But I think with something like letter writing, you kind of have to say, okay, you almost have to put, you know, if you're talking about young people, you have to almost put things in front of them and say, okay, well, this is what my grandfather wrote, you know, during the war. And in the book, there's a wonderful sequence which I was so fortunate to obtain from the two sons of the correspondent in the book. It's a wonderful sequence of letters during the war from a postman who was working for the Signal Corps in North Africa and Greece in 1943 and 1944. And he wrote to someone that he used to know back in London, you know, during the Blitz, and the bombs were dropping, and you get all that wonderful history, and in great detail as well. But what you also get is this wonderful developing love story between them, so they hardly knew each other. So it's that kind of thing. You sort of want to say, okay, now read this and say, this is what it used to be like, this is what we're going to lose. Now show me an equivalent in texting or emails or something like that. But the sort of scary thing, as I kind of mentioned a little bit, is that whole thing that emails are a passing phase. This is what you know, archivists really believe now, that actually young people kind of think that, you know, the formality of an email is even too much, because you've got to sit down and write it in a certain way. You can't use text language. You have to put someone's address in the special field, and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But that's becoming too much of an effort, and all we're going to be left with are these little words, you know, little short lines in the ether, with which somehow we're going to have to patch together our history in 100 or 200 or 300 years' time. And you can say, okay, well, will that matter? But I think it does.
You take us back to ancient Rome, ancient Greece, and to correspondence as it has sort of evolved through the years. And another interesting facet of your book is from time to time there will be these chapters called How to Write the Perfect Letter, in which you explore some of the different ways in which one can sort of hone one's skills as a communicator in the writing of letters. And there is a wonderful chapter which is called Love in Its Later Forms, which explores this notion of the love letter. And, of course, you take us through some of history's most intriguing love letters and write at one point, love letters catch us at a time in our lives when our marrow is jelly, but we toughen up, our souls harden, and we reread them years later with a mixture of disbelief and cringing horror and, worst of all, level judgment. I think that's so interesting that in a sense a letter preserves a moment in our lives when we, in a sense, were someone else. And even when it is we ourselves who wrote the letter, we can sometimes read it and feel like we're reading the words of a stranger. I wonder if you could just say a word about that, if you've experienced that yourself or can think of interesting examples.
Yeah, well, I mean, exactly, you know, as you say, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to kind of write those words had I not felt that way myself when I was a teenager in love for the first time. We would, you know, I'd write letters, and fortunately, I still got a kind of great shoebox full of letters that my first proper girlfriend wrote to me when I was 16, 17, and they're great things. They're incredibly embarrassing, of course, but they tell you who you were, you know, at that time, as you say, and they're wonderful things to have, partly also because they're handwritten and they're sort of from the heart, the thing with emails is they all look the same, so you can say anything on them, but actually they will look the same as if they came from no matter who. They wouldn't have a kind of personality to them in the presentation, in the way they feel. And, yeah, no, in the book, I sort of, you know, in that chapter that you mentioned, I begin with John Keats, and he is dying, you know, in his 20s. He's in Italy. He goes to Italy because he's been told that the air there is better for this terrible disease he has in his lungs. And he writes the most beautiful letters, not only to his girlfriend, Fanny Braun, but also to his friends back in London. And as you would expect from someone like John Keats, they're fantastically poetic letters. I'm lucky enough to live in London, just around the corner from where he used to live when he was in London, in Hampstead. And I went to see some of the letters there. They've obviously got them preserved behind glass cases. But they're lovely, flowery things. And you can also witness the decline in his health from the way he writes as well. It's clear as that. And then I link it to, he writes to a friend called Charles Brown. So I thought, okay, well, that's an obvious link to Charlie Brown. And then I start talking about how Charlie Brown in the Peanut strip didn't get any love letters. You know, he would have put his hand as deep, deep, deep inside in the postbox as he possibly could, you know, and there would never be anything there for him. And not all the cartoons, but half the cartoons would be about that. You know, would he get any letters from the redhead girl that he fancied? And then I go, you know, to Charles Schulz, and when he died, these letters came out, which revealed an affair that he was having, you know, a great love affair with another woman. So, you know, it's a whole circle of life that you can link through letters, and a remarkable thing. And the thing to, you know, for instance, I have a letter from Charles Schulz, where he obviously writes to his friend, and he has cartoons in there as well, you know. So obviously he would do cartoons of Charlie Brown or whoever, and then you look at some of the letters from the great artists. My favorite letter, which I talk about right at the end of the book, which I wanted to buy until I realized how much it was going to cost me, is a fantastic letter from Edward Manet, where he writes just to a friend, but he also draws, and that's what you can't get in an email either.
That's very, very true. And you have further intriguing examples of letters of Virginia Woolf, Jack Kerouac, Emily Dickinson, an amazing five-word letter which she writes at the very end of her life, and touch on other important letters from throughout history, an account of the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. All that we know firsthand comes from someone writing a letter about that incredible moment. And that and much, much more. I think we come to the end of your book and realize that, in fact, it would be a very different world without the letters that have been written down through the centuries. The book is called To the Letter, A Celebration of the Lost Art of Letter Writing, published by Gotham Books. Simon Garfield, I thank you for writing this superb book, and I'm glad we got to talk about it today on the Morning
Show.
Well,
I'm glad too, Greg, and thanks ever so much for having me on.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we are looking forward to another visit from Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College. He joins us once a month to offer his astute analysis of current events and issues. We want to remind you once again of Wisconsin Public Radio's year-end membership drive. It's an opportunity for you to make one more donation to Wisconsin Public Radio, or to maybe make your first donation to Wisconsin Public Radio. WGTD is part of Wisconsin Public Radio, and every dollar you donate to Wisconsin Public Radio supports us and what we do and what you hear over the airwaves of FM 91.1. So if you appreciate what you hear over WGTD, please go to WPR.org.